The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Wednesday, October 4th, 2016. Remember, we'll be up late tonight following the VP debates with Debate Rewind, starting at 11 p.m. Eastern on WNYC.org and some of our favorite public radio stations. Give us a call at 800-543-2543 and let us know your take. That's Debate Rewind tonight at 11 p.m. Eastern.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And here's a man who's seen it all, Frank Thompson, former head of prisons in the state of Oregon, speaking candidly about his own many encounters with death.
So I'm an old country boy. I can remember having to euthanize an old cow. I can remember having to put down a horse. I see a couple of people nodding their heads. That wasn't easy back then. And can you imagine going into a cell and sitting as close to an individual as I am, this gentleman, and talking to him about the process that I'm called upon to administer? The state doesn't have the right to ask any employee to go through that.
He's a veteran who fought his way home from Vietnam and learned a lot about justice along the way. He speaks on The Takeaway later this hour in a remarkable conversation that may just cause you to completely rethink your approach to capital punishment. But we begin this hour with vice presidential candidates Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, who will face off in their first and only debate tonight. It might be a bit of relief for us all not to have to gaze open-mouthed at what Donald Trump just said or try to discern what Hillary Clinton really meant with what she just said. Pence is a first-term governor of Indiana, former congressman. He's up against Tim Kaine, the former governor and now junior senator from Virginia. Do voters really know much about either of these two men? Not really. A recent ABC poll said that 40% of those people polled couldn't name either vice presidential pick. We're here to help, though. We solicited your questions for tonight. If you were the debate moderator, what would you ask Mike Pence and Tim Kaine? Huh? You sent in all kinds of questions about the economy, immigration, and healthcare. You've got questions, we've got answers. From Indiana is Nikki Kelly, Indianapolis Bureau reporter for the Fort Wayne Gazette, who's been following Governor Pence throughout the campaign. And from Virginia, Bob Holsworth, a political analyst and founding director of the Center for Public Policy at Virginia Commonwealth University, who knows Senator Kaine very well. Nikki and Bob, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to be here.
All right, Bob, here's something from one of our listeners regarding Senator Kaine. Portland, Oregon. For Tim Kaine, I'd ask what he brings to the table as far as agenda and policy go that haven't been worked into a Clinton-Sanders platform. We don't know that much about Kaine, the policy guy.
Well, I think on this front, Tim Kaine is going to suggest that he's the vice president for Hillary Clinton, and it's not so much that he brings a unique policy perspective as much as he brings an approach to policy that he will argue can be more effective. Kaine will talk about how he has spent his career being a bridge builder. When he was a city council person in Richmond, he helped to bridge a long and somewhat intractable racial divide that existed in the city. He's going to argue that as governor, he was able, on occasion at least, to bring Republicans and Democrats together to pass a smoking ban in public places in Virginia. And I think he's going to argue that both as senator and as vice president, what he has done is that while sticking to his principles, he's also tried very strongly to work with other people who don't share all of his policy ideas to get things done.
Now, a listener in Colorado Springs wanted to know, Governor Pence was famously quoted as saying he was a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican, and in that order, I know what that means to me, says this listener, but what does that mean to him? What does implementation of policy look like to him, stressing that list of priorities? What do you think?
Well, I mean, he still uses that line every day in his stump speech, and he definitely believes that he focuses on his Christian beliefs first, which can be evidenced in some bills he signed here in Indiana, specifically an abortion bill that was struck down. What I do find interesting about that statement, the more I hear him say it, is that at least for this race, it seems like the conservative and Republican have switched place a little, because Donald Trump definitely has some policy proposals and programs that are not as conservative.
Nikki, Governor Pence describes himself as a Rush Limbaugh kind of character. Limbaugh's got one-liners. He's made a career of one-liners. Do you expect one-liners to come from Governor Pence regarding Senator Kaine? And where do you think they would come from in terms of subject matter?
Oh, I'm sure he'll have a few built into his talking points. If there's anything you can say about Governor Pence is, you know, he stays on message. He has discipline, and he will definitely get some points on Senator Kaine. And I'm not exactly sure where he might put them. Probably foreign policy would be a big spot for him. But he likes to have a few lines in his speeches for sure.
A joke all in Spanish from Senator Kaine, Bob Holdsworth?
I'm not sure you're going to see that, but what you will see is that Tim Kaine, prior to entering politics, was a very effective courtroom litigator. And I think people who see him as just this kind of genial cheerleader for Hillary Clinton could well be surprised tonight by how effective an advocate he is.
Bob and Nikki, I thank you, and our listeners definitely thank you for very forthright answers to their very forthright questions. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nikki Kelly is State House Bureau Chief at the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette, and Dr. Bob Holdsworth is the Managing Principal of Decide Smart and Founding Director of the Center for Public Policy at Virginia Commonwealth University.
This is Jane from Omaha, Nebraska. I wonder how close Pence's positions will be to Trump's. Can he support the things that Donald Trump has said about the Muslims, about stop and frisk? I just would not want to be in Mike Pence's shoes on Tuesday evening.
Richmond, Virginia, I would like to know what they would do if they disagree with a policy their running mate is espousing. Salt Lake City, Utah, I would ask, are you at all interested in running for president sometime in the future? To both of them. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Okay, I defy any of you out there to find me a case where a vice presidential debate had any significance whatsoever to the outcome of a presidential race. Huh? Huh? See? But that doesn't mean there aren't memorable moments. Like when Al Gore told Vice President Bush he was fixing to put Bush out of a job. Or this moment back in 1984.
Despite the historic aspects of your candidacy, how do you account for the fact that a majority of women, at least according to the polls, favor the Reagan-Bush ticket over the Mondale-Ferraro ticket?
I don't. Let me say that I'm not a believer in polls.
There was this moment where Ross Perot's admiral running mate kind of lost his compass heading on national television.
Admiral Stockdale, your opening statement, please, sir.
Who am I? Why am I here?
Admiral James Stockdale there in 92. But the best moment for my taste had to be in 1988 when Senator Lloyd Benston had this to say when Senator Dan Quayle casually compared himself to John F. Kennedy.
I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency.
Senator Benson?
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
The man who loaded that zinger into the chamber is Dennis Eckert, a former Ohio congressman and longtime debate coach. He says Veep debates are not really about winning and losing.
Well, there's very few what would be classically thought of maybe even as defining moments. Some of them are mostly accident. Stockdale wondering, you know, why was he here as they pinned his microphone on. Quayle, not the JFK line was memorable, but for the whole evening, he sort of stood there. He had the podium in a virtual death grip, betraying his, you know, his complete lack of confidence there. I guess I'd also just point to, Al Gore's sighing, President Bush idly glancing at his watch. I mean, what I tell folks when we coach is, you know, Dan Rather wrote a book, the title of which, The Camera Never Blinks. Well, the reality is that the moment they pin that microphone on, virtually everything you say and do, audible or inaudible, rhetorical or not, goes into the public's perception of what the evening is all about. And therefore, what you are all about.
Is there something unusual about this debate in 2016 in that it's the first chance to get a look at the ticket with a little bit of Trump relief. He's nowhere to be found. And, you know, Hillary relief is also probably something that the voters are looking for. It's a way of evaluating the ticket in a different way all of a sudden.
It places these two men in a context separate from their partners. And by that, I simply mean we get to see them talk about policy, their pedigree, their biography. But we also don't have it, as you point out in your question, the overhang of the principles, you know, just looming about them. And it is the one time, separate from the 28-second sound bites we get in TV commercials, where not only do we get to see what they think or hear what they think, but we get to see how they think. And people realize that there is more than just the soundbite to any of these individuals.
I'm wondering with the Pence, if he goes out and attempts to say, you know, don't worry about all the wild stuff that Donald Trump is saying. I'll keep him honest. I'll keep him on the you know, center line of the road. You know, do a little bit of a Dick Cheney. Is that a good thing, or does that ultimately backfire?
I think Pence might want to even emphasize some of his differences. For example, he has not been afraid to publicly say some things that are counter to what Trump is saying. He released the tax information, for example. He is going to want to talk, I think, or certainly convey a steadiness in his demeanor and a steadfastness to very conservative principles, which we know about in his record from Washington and in the governor's office. He can provide, I guess, a note of stability to a campaign that seems, with Donald Trump careening wildly about all four lanes of the freeway of politics. Pence is going to be your steady and true and consistent conservative with a more calming demeanor than the frequently peripatetic Trump leaping all over the stage.
All right. Before we go, here's the tasty stuff now. You came up with the Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy line. So who would you want to coach here, Senator Kaine or Governor Pence?
I would rather coach Senator Kaine. I think he has a warmth which is very important in the Clinton-Kaine being likable. He represents the traditional Catholic vote, which is very important in a state like Pennsylvania and also in Florida. And I think Tim Kaine has a flexibility. You feel that he's speaking to you personally. Governor Pence can be just a little conservatively robotic, and it just might require a little more work to make him more human. But certainly, I think both of these folks are stark contrasts to the presidential nominees and can complement them in a ways that, frankly, both Trump and Hillary Clinton need to have done tonight.
All right. Dennis Eckert, thanks so much.
Great. Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be with you.
A milestone to report, but does it have any meaning on the ground in Syria's civil war? The United States has suspended talks with Russia over the war in Syria, accusing Russia of failing to live up to its commitments. Secretary of State John Kerry has accused Russia of destabilizing the region. There are reports that Russia is sending SA-22 surface-to-air defense missiles into Syria to protect Assad's regime and Russian forces from American warplanes. Andrew Kramer is a reporter for our partner, the New York Times, in Moscow. He says the consequences of this suspension are largely symbolic for now, but still alarming.
I don't mean to speak too generally about Russians, but there is a belief among Russians that things can always get worse. And that's what we're seeing now in relations with the United States. What happened yesterday was the State Department informed Russia it would halt cooperation on peace negotiations in Syria. And really, in expectation of that announcement, although not formally linked to it, President Putin announced that he would withdraw from a post-Cold War era nuclear agreement having to do with plutonium disposal. So we have an unraveling on both sides. A discussion about Syria. We have both countries flying fighter jets over Syria, potential for mishaps there, and Moscow shifting the discussion to nuclear security and nuclear disarmament treaties.
On the nuclear question for just a moment, is there any practical consequence of the rejection of this post-Cold War era treaty?
Not so much, but it depends on how it's looked at. Plutonium has an extraordinarily long half-life. So leaving plutonium in storage means that humanity has a risk that's just out there for potentially hundreds of years. In the immediate future, the implication is that this plutonium will not be monitored or controlled by a bilateral treaty that had mandated both countries to dispose of 34 tons of plutonium. This is enough plutonium to make several thousand, many thousands of nuclear bombs. The Russians have said that although they've withdrawn from this treaty, they still won't use the plutonium for military purposes. So in the short term, it's more symbolic. In the long term, it leaves open this lingering question that was left outstanding after the end of the Cold War on what to do with all of this doomsday material. It will be with us for some time, apparently.
Do we know when the last time was that either the Russians or the United States disposed of a sizable, significant amount of plutonium, and any indication what the latest update of the accounting of what's left that supposedly was being monitored under this treaty?
I think that both countries from time to time reprocess plutonium for various purposes. The most obvious purpose is to create something called mixed oxide fuel, which can be used in a civilian nuclear power plant to generate electricity. And this process renders the plutonium useless for nuclear weapons. It transforms it into a different material through the nuclear reaction. The Russians have embraced this, and they have built a facility to process plutonium into mixed oxide fuel and then subsequently burn it in a reactor. And small portions of the plutonium have been processed in this way. The U.S. has likely, on an experimental level, done this. However, the industrial facility in South Carolina is not finished yet and is not budgeted for next year because of glitches and cost overruns. The U.S. proposal is to bury the plutonium and hope for the best. Some experts in this field say that's actually a superior solution because the risk of transporting plutonium to reprocessing facilities and moving it to civilian reactors is greater from the point of view of nonproliferation than simply burying it underground.
Well, that's great information. It certainly sounds like neither side has been terribly responsible or serious about the plutonium disposal, but that's neither here nor there. Let's talk about Syria in the remaining couple of minutes that we have. It's not as though the cooperation between Russia and the United States over Syria has made any tangible diminishing of the civil war in Syria. What do you think the consequence is of this lack of cooperation, aside from, you know, accidents in the air?
Well, it would certainly be better for everybody if Russia and the United States could bet together on Syria. There's been reports coming out of Aleppo, which is a focus of the war now, of extensive bombing and shelling of civilian areas by the Assad government with backing from Russia, maybe even Russian airplanes involved in that very careless targeting of civilian areas. So that will likely or presumably continue. There are not many options for the United States to confront Russia militarily without starting, well, as the Russians pointed out, a nuclear war, and pointed out with their statement and their announcement of withdrawing from this nuclear treaty to sort of draw people's attention to the stakes here. There's been a report that Russia is moving the S-300 anti-aircraft system into Syria. There already is an S-400 guarding the Russian base there. So these would be systems likely capable of shooting down American airplanes if they were put to use and handed over to the Assad government. That's not confirmed yet that's happened, but that was a report today. So the options are limited, I think, for military solutions. It's really, you know, which country is willing to play chicken more aggressively here. The U.S. could also get involved in this game and start targeting, for example, Assad government forces or supplying weapons to rebels that would be more effective in rebuffing airstrikes, but once again, at the risk of more directly confronting Russia.
Syrian government forces have suggested that they're trying to take East Aleppo away from the opposition. Are Russian media confirming that that is indeed the case? Are Russian military units assisting in that? And will they describe the final takeover of that opposition stronghold as a liberation of Aleppo if it happens?
They would most likely describe it as a liberation. The Russian position is that there is a government in Syria, the Assad regime, and then there is a terrorist rebellion. And they don't make too many distinctions between the various factions that are fighting the Assad government, ranging from the Free Syrian Army to the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. So they just lump all of these groups together as terrorists. And that's generally how the reporting here has covered the battle for Aleppo.
Well, that's pretty grim. Andrew Kramer, thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you for having me on.
Andrew Kramer is a reporter for The New York Times based in Moscow.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Shoot to kill. Is that a message from the street that explains a surprising level of shooting fatalities in Baltimore? A year-long investigation by the Baltimore Sun finds that aside from the notoriety from the Freddie Gray case, which we will talk about in a moment, Baltimore, the city, is among the most deadly in the country. New chilling research finds that one in three people shot in Baltimore in 2015 wound up dead. Compare that to Chicago, a city notorious for its gun violence, but where it's more like one in six die in a shooting. Here's Thomas Scalia, Maryland Shock Trauma Center's physician-in-chief.
The thing that is particularly disheartening this year is it seems like we're seeing more people shot more times, not shot once, but shot twice, three, four, five times. And that makes it infinitely harder to care for them.
Are the gun criminals in Baltimore lucky or just better at what they do than shooters in other cities? Justin George is the Baltimore Sun crime reporter who oversaw a team of investigators to do this story.
One thing that we found out, especially, you know, me as a crime reporter here in Baltimore, is that we noticed that a lot of the shootings that occurred were fatal. And so as we were kind of watching each sort of fatality come in from a gun homicide, we started noticing also that a lot of people were shot in the head. So we decided to just try to figure out how lethal these shootings were. In a lot of cases, you know, to see how many people would survive versus how many died. And what we ended up finding out was that Baltimore is a very lethal town where in every three shootings, one person dies.
And that compares how to other cities around the country?
Well, in a place like New York, it's out of every five shootings, one person dies. And in other places like, you know, Milwaukee, it's a similar ratio. L.A., it is out of every six shootings, one person dies. In general, I think most cities kind of span the spectrum of between 1 to 7 and 1 to 5.
So you would say a 1 to 3 ratio represents something different going on in Baltimore?
Yeah, I mean, it made me wonder what, you know, the criminals taking a target practice? What is going on? How is their aim so precise?
Any clues to either why the aim is so good or why the intent to kill is so apparent in the bullet wounds themselves?
Well, I think it's what we found out as far as, you know, what's going on in the street is there are a lot of known suspects and known victims. And while that is true in a lot of places, I think Baltimore is a very small town, a town with deep roots. And I think by just knowing each other, and there was a very terrible sort of sinister way about some of these homicides in that people who know each other are getting close to each other, whether it be, you know, in a disagreement because you know somebody, or it may be through actual sort of a planned target. You get close to somebody and then they are shooting them at close range. But in addition to that, we were also finding a lot of evidence that showed that things had changed that were very much outside of Baltimore's control.
Here's something I wouldn't even dignify by saying it's a theory, but it is very chilling. The fact that Baltimore is on a kind of cinematic stage, there's The Wire, there are other, you know, depictions of violence in Baltimore that have made it to the big screen and the small screen. Is there any sense that people in Baltimore are aware of that and are performing in some sense?
Well, you know, some detectives have mentioned that, but you got to understand that The Wire, you know, was very much rooted in reality. Even before it aired, it very much sort of represented or reflected what was going on in the streets. David Simon was, you know, held my position as a crime reporter at the Baltimore Sun. So what was going on way before. And as we looked at the lethality rates, you know, they've always remained high in Baltimore. Like, you know, about a decade ago, it was about 1 to 4, and that narrowed about 1 to 3. So it's always been very high, and there have always been sort of a lot of headshots in this intent to kill.
What's been the response to your reporting, and what do you hope the response would be?
You know, I think there's this myth out there that, you know, trauma surgeons and medical advancements are saving more people. And while that's true, they cannot keep up with the shootings and what's going on. People are coming in with more multiple gunshot wounds. People are coming in being shot with higher caliber guns, and they just can't keep up.
Justin George is a Baltimore Sun crime reporter who led the team of investigators that showed this 1-in-3 ratio of fatalities in the city of Baltimore as far as shootings are concerned. Thanks so much, Justin.
You're welcome.
Humble in defeat, not a chance.
In these cases, my prosecutors presented a great deal of evidence to support the charges alleged. And although we came close to convicting one of the officers, the judge, who is within his right, has made it clear that he doesn't agree with the state's theory of the case.
A dogged, unhesitating search for justice in the death of Freddie Gray in April of 2015 ended with cases dropped and 3 acquittals. Baltimore City Attorney Marilyn Roseby's promise that this case would be different than so many others in America goes unfulfilled.
To the people of Baltimore and the demonstrators across America, I heard your call for no justice, no peace. Your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of this young man.
Mosby's visibility, along with her city council member husband Nick, made them a power couple in the middle of a national story on police brutality and racism in America. The very personal saga of Mosby and her husband is chronicled in the article Baltimore versus Marilyn Mosby by Will Hilton, contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. It's a story that touches everything from centuries-old racial history in Baltimore to the Mosbys' suddenly skittish marriage.
Before Marilyn Mosby, the top prosecutor in Baltimore, took office, you had prosecutors for Ferguson, Missouri, and for Staten Island fail to indict police officers in the cases of Eric Garner and Michael Brown. And so the mood of the country was one largely of sort of disbelief and outrage. And so when the Freddie Gray death happened in April of that year, she was already in a position of power and in a psychological position where she was prepared to take the close look at this that other prosecutors had failed to do. And this was the kind of case, the kind of difficult decision that I think she, you know, had been gearing up for since law school anyway, but in some ways for all of her life.
How does her husband Nick figure into the story and complicate matters really for both of them?
Nick is a member of the city council here in Baltimore. He's absolutely been a rising star in Baltimore city politics. And so Nick was on a track that seemed very clearly and may still very clearly be, well, that Nick will be mayor someday. But his announcement of his campaign for mayor in the middle of last year was right after Marilyn's announcement that she was going to be prosecuting 6 police officers for Freddie Gray's death. And so the charges that she was filing seemed to bring that controversy into his campaign. But then his campaign also seemed to bring the veneer of politics into her prosecutorial process. And so for each of them, their close connection to each other created an additional challenge. But the question really about why she wasn't able to get the convictions, I think, comes down to whether it was mistakes that she made or, as she sees it, that the obstruction and intransigence of the police department prevented her from getting the kinds of evidence that she needed and which maybe existed and that she believed she would be able to procure but was unable to.
Did the judge hand her head in these acquittals? And what was the significance of the police department feeling as though it was under siege here in the way that the prosecutor was handling these cases?
So in the case of the judge, you certainly had the feeling that the judge was unimpressed at many moments in the trials. He seemed to be shaking his head and sort of exasperated by things that it appeared that he saw as mistakes. In the case of how cops have reacted, it's been terrible. I mean, if you talk to longtime cops in Baltimore, rightly or wrongly, the sentiment is pervasive that they're worried that the state's attorney is going to press charges against them for what they perceive as doing their jobs. And so their reaction to that is to do less than full endeavor. And so I had cops sitting at my house with me, cops with decades of experience, saying things like the relationship between the police and the prosecutors in Baltimore is broken. It's fractured. It's a fractured relationship. And you can expect 300 murders a year from now on. Last year, we had a 63% increase in murders. And to think that that has something to do with this destroyed relationship between the police and the city's prosecutors is really unsettling.
Is that how people are seeing this in the community?
I would say that's how cops are seeing it. I think within the community, there's a tremendous amount of support for Mosby. You know, within a lot of the community of Baltimore, there's been a sense that cops have been coming in and abusing people for so long. The idea that the cops were being charged and the sort of larger presumption that that means they're going to be held accountable in future incidents, I think is greeted with gratitude.
Nevertheless, would you say that this power couple, Nick and Marilyn Mosby, have fallen from grace?
I would. I'd say that it's been a very dramatic fall. You know, Nick was on his way to becoming mayor, is now abandoned his campaign for mayor and also given up his seat on the council. Marilyn will remain in the top prosecutor's chair for at least another 2 years, but far from the sort of halo that seemed to be around her. Now the sort of split, the fault lines within the city are opened up around her office. The fault lines with the police department are opened up, and she's just certainly not in the position that she was in.
Will Hilton, this is a hard question to ask, and I suspect it's a hard subject for you to talk about. Nevertheless, because these people are so public, what's been the impact on their relationship?
Marilyn talked to me about that a number of times, and then they talked about it with each other for the first time in the middle of one of our get-togethers. I think the way I would characterize, I don't want to ventriloquize for them, but I think the way I would characterize what they said was that the basis of their relationship since they met at Tuskegee when they were, you know, 18 and 19 years old has been this sort of shared political sensibility. They have come up through life together. And because of their separate positions, because of the appearances of conflict between them, they started to reduce the communication. And I think that whatever else is happening between them, they were very clear that not being able to talk about their work lives at home, and that without it, they said there's a chasm. There's this big set of issues that they can't talk about with each other, about which they would rather talk than almost anything. It's almost no subject that they've talked about for longer and more detail. And so it's really a big loss. And what it meant, as I began to understand it, is that, you know, you really have to think about what the fallout has been from Freddie Gray's death. There's been just, their scars are everywhere, beginning with Freddie Gray's family, but then this big issue of, you know, cops and prosecutors having trouble cooperating on cases, and all these other political careers that have gone down. Tony Bassett, police commissioner, is gone. Stephanie Rawlings Blake, the mayor, is not going to stay in the office because of it. And yet at the deepest level, the person who's paid the greatest price is Marilyn Mosby, the person who set out fervently to make sure someone did pay a price, and it ended up being her.
Will Hilton is a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine and author of the article Baltimore versus Marilyn Mosby, and he's the author most recently of the book Vanished. Thanks so much, Will.
Oh, my pleasure.
For the first time since 1971, less than half of Americans support the death penalty. That's according to a Pew poll released last week, which found that 49% support capital punishment, 42% are opposed. Back during the height of the Vietnam War, America had a whole different concept of criminal justice. In the days of the gas chamber, the firing squad, the gallows, and the electric chair, there was a deliberateness about executing criminals that, as the war ended, Americans generally and gradually turned away from. Frank Thompson was fighting for his life as a soldier in Vietnam back in the 70s. When he returned to civilian life, he joined the Oregon Department of Corrections, eventually becoming top prison official in the state. As superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary from 1994 to 1998, Frank oversaw the state's only two executions in the last 54 years. And that's all it took for Thompson to become a changed man regarding the power of the state to take a human life. Thompson now serves as an advocate against the death penalty. But surprisingly, Thompson said that when he took the prison job a long time ago, the last thing he ever expected was to feel any misgivings about killing murderers.
So when I became a superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary, the notion of having to take a life was nothing new to me. Training, knowing yourself under difficult and emergency situations and having to think rationally and logically and keep in focus protocol and procedures was not a new skill for me. So I went into it prepared to do, as many soldiers do as they volunteer for our military, prepared to do what we need to do in our profession. Well, within 18 months, I was assigned the job of executing someone, and I had to assist in rewriting the policies and the procedures from death by gas to death by lethal injections. And it forced me to come to grips with how I really stood about the death penalty. And all of the flaws with the death penalty, one by one, just came into focus, and I had to reckon with them. And I realized that I was leading a group of men and women into the process of how to kill a person, how to take the life of a human being in the name of a public policy that could not be shown to make the public any safer.
When you were doing that and you went home at night, did someone ask you, well, how was your day? And did it feel much different to answer that question when you were doing that versus a normal day at the Oregon State Pen?
I think only at home. We didn't talk about that side of my job. When they don't know what it is to walk inside of an institution every day and the door's locked behind you. And I wanted to protect my family, and it worked well. So I didn't get that at home. But on the job, now I tell you the point where the concern about each other's well-being sort of came to a peak. In the process of that first execution, I came to the realization that I was at my very core against the death penalty. And I don't supervise and guide people toward a goal, thinking one way and acting another. I have to be in concert. So I went to my staff and said, look, folks, I can't come to say that I support the death penalty. And I want you to know that. And I, under the law, the only person that was required to carry out the protocols of the death penalty was the superintendent. Everybody else volunteered, and I let them know that I would understand if someone opted not to go through with it. And I almost choke up at this moment when I think about to the person, because they believed in me and they believed that a stable society needed professionals who could do the tough work. They stuck with me all the way through. And it was at that time we sort of took inventory of how each other were doing.
If in your moral core it was wrong to you the first time, it must have been so difficult that second time.
It wasn't any easier, but I believe that any stable society has to have professionals that can do the difficult jobs, even if they don't believe in it, as long as they have the ability and the capacity to work to correct the system. I was a soldier in the Vietnam era. I didn't believe in the Vietnam War, and I demonstrated against the Vietnam War after I came out. So in a very similar sense, between the two executions, I went to my director, and I actually said to him, I can do my job as long as I have an ability to criticize, knowing that the director was going to talk to the governor, and you know that's input. It takes an inside person to have that kind of a voice. That's one of the problems in this country is, I feel anyway, we too often have to make changes from without, in the street, from the outside force. But if you have the capacity to make change from within, from a credible experience, that's the way to make a real difference. And I think I've laid some fingerprints in that area here in Oregon that I'm very, very proud of.
So let's say you encounter someone who has also been in military service and has seen suicide bombers in Iraq and their friends and fellow soldiers killed and maimed from IEDs, and they also are in the penitentiary, and they also encounter someone who has committed a horrible crime, and they say to you, I am so enthusiastic about putting this person to death. How could you possibly argue against it? What would you say to them?
I would say to them, I can almost relate to your feelings because I had a best friend. His name is John Tillman Hussey, who was a police officer who was abducted by felons who were attempting to avoid being captured, and they killed him. And I can remember when I was supporting the death penalty, hoping that those persons would get caught and that they would be executed. So I would say to that person, I understand those emotions, but vengeance does not make good public policy. Capital punishment is a public policy that is supposed to have an outcome that protects the public and makes it safer holistically.
And capital punishment doesn't make the public safer?
Oh, absolutely not.
Is there something about the manner in which their lives were extinguished that you retain as a particular memory?
Yes. During the process of one of the executions, one of the individuals let us know that the straps binding his hands to the gurney was hurting his hands. And I gave instructions to make adjustments so that his hands wouldn't hurt. And the adjustments were made, and he looked at me and said, "Thank you, boss." I think that's a moment where the humanity of individuals involved in a terrible process speaks out.
Frank Thompson, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to get this message out.
Frank Thompson was the superintendent of the Oregon State Penitentiary from 1994 to 1998. To give some context to Frank's point on public safety, murder rates in non-death penalty states are consistently lower than those with the death penalty, 4.4 per 100,000 people versus 3.4 per 100,000 people. And a recent survey of criminologists by the University of Colorado found that 88% of criminologists believe that the death penalty does not act as a deterrent for future crimes. And here's something to take with you today. As the seasons change and cooler weather gradually approaches, let's consider a mysterious transition of the gas helium that takes place at about 2 degrees above absolute zero. After furiously bubbling as the temperature declines at about 2 degrees above zero Kelvin, it stops, completely stops. Solving the mathematical riddle of the behavior of so-called superfluids or related superconductors is at the heart of the research that won the Nobel Prize for Physics today. Three British scientists studying matter in its most bizarre states share the prize: David Thewlis, Duncan Haldane, and Michael Kosterlitz at the University of Washington, Princeton, and Brown. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.